So the next session picks up. We're going to look now at schools, at school policy and so on. And I'm really what we're going to do here is just have each of the people that you see at the panel deliver their thought, bomb, sentence, whatever it is, and then we'll start as we did before and have a panel discussion. So, Mike, do you want to start? Mike Moses, if you look at your... I'm trying to minimize the amount of reading out from this thing because you can see these things. He's currently senior advisor for Raise Your Hand Texas, but used to be commissioner of education for the state of Texas. So there seems to be a lot of Texas here.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Roger. Good morning to everyone. And I guess that's just because Texas and California go well together. I don't know. Certainly a pleasure to be here. Appreciate the organizers of the conference. Certainly the National Science Foundation and the work that's done at the center with all the other sponsors is greatly admired and appreciated. As Roger said, I had the opportunity to work at the state level in Texas as well as at the district level in four different school districts, the last being Dallas. In Texas as school superintendent. And I guess some quick takeaways, and I think we've been asked to maybe just to react to some comments this morning. Obviously, a tremendous amount of information and knowledge about learning, about this science of educating that's extremely important. But I also think that what Mike said this morning about translation and translating good research back to the schools, and his statement that perhaps we've done that clumsily. I don't know about that, but I would say that how we get researchers and educators talking to each other is really important. I think it's important that we not assume too much. It's important that the researchers not assume too much. The vocabulary is very interesting, but educators, I would have to say, I think, have to be brought up to speed on a lot of things as it pertains to the information, particularly with regard to neurons, synapses, the cortex, the lining of the cortex, the growth of the cortex, the thickness of the cortex. And we have our own nomenclature in education that's also very can be very daunting and confusing, and we have to be very careful about breaking all that down and not assuming too much. I think how we get this research in the hands of credible associations, organizations that are trusted by school districts, trusted by school executives, is extremely important. I know there's concern about content and processes, and that's important. That's important in terms of how children learn, not just what they learn, but how they learn and the speed at which they learn. But we're in a high-stakes era in American education today. Results are expected. Accountability is real for school superintendents, for school boards, for principals, teachers. And whether we like it or not, we do keep score. And so somehow we have to find a way for the research to match up with the expectations that teachers and educators face in our schools. We've got to have results to show. The research has to show results because school leaders are going to be asking, the first question is, how is this going to help my kids? Show me results. Show me evidence of learning. The technology that was mentioned, the repetitions, I do believe that's important. I believe the teacher does come first, but I think the repetitions of learning, the repetition, the drill and practice is extremely going to be important. Charter schools may be a place where we may be able to do some things with research that we might not do with all public schools, even though I think good charter schools in our state, charter schools are public schools, but I think they are places where we can perhaps do some things together. I was really, the time and timing discussion, extremely important. Really interested in that, as well as discussion of physical activity and its effect on learning. Ken Cooper at the Aerobics Center in Dallas, Texas, who wrote the book Aerobics, is doing a tremendous amount of work with regard to physical activity in Texas, and this last legislative session just passed a law to require more physical activity, primarily at the urging of Dr. Kenneth Cooper, who really believes this development of the brain and this development of synapses is tied to physical activity. And he is really interested in the growing body of research that's in that area. A couple of things I didn't hear this morning, and I'm anxious to hear more and learn more today, is one, we have to crack the code with regard to the education of second language learners. And I know that's being worked on as well, but when we talk to educators across the country, particularly in California, Texas, Florida, across the Southwest, but really anywhere in the United States, this is a growing challenge, and it's one that we need the best minds working on, the best thinking, and the best research being brought to the table with regard to that. And then I don't know if that's a bomb or not, but finally, here's my last bomb. We probably need a clearinghouse. Educators listen to brain researchers, reading researchers, behavior researchers, and they're very powerful and they're very thoughtful and they're brilliant people. But educators somehow need the best thinking brought together and perhaps a clearinghouse where the common ground can be found. Everyone may not agree on everything, but we need to find the areas where there is undeniable common ground so that can be brought to the public schools and all of our schools. Hopefully, I think that would be something that might come out of this conference. Thank you.
Great, thank you. Let's go to the other end of the table now to Patricia Wright, Pat Wright, who is Chief Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction for the Virginia Department of Education. Is there anything else you'd like to context?
That's quite fine. Thank you. I am here today representing the deputies from the state education agencies, and I'd like to recognize my colleagues who are in the audience this morning. Please raise your hand. My deputy friends, they are acknowledging that they're still my friends. any one of these individuals could be sitting here today, so I'll try not to speak strictly from Virginia's perspective, but try to represent the broader perspective. As I was sitting through the first panel, I thought a lot about Kathleen Laos because I was thinking maybe I was an English language learner waiting for someone to provide a plain language translation of the research. And I don't say that to denigrate anyone. I have a tremendous amount of respect for what you do, and I think it's the research on neuroscience is very, very powerful. The deputies are working with scientific learning in a research and development project, and one of our goals is really to merge the educator with the scientist, and that hopefully in our roles as state education agency deputies, we can help filter the research down to the schools in understandable language, because just knowing is not a sufficient condition. It's a necessary condition to make changes, but it's not sufficient. My background's mathematics, and I will answer the question on geometry, because geometry today is not the same as geometry yesterday, even the geometry that I took. In fact, we do teach geometry in algebra in kindergarten through eighth grade before many kids start their formal algebra experience in algebra and geometry in seventh, eighth, or ninth. And so the geometry we teach today is an algebraic basis, so you have to have some formal algebra to be able to successfully solve the geometric problems that are proposed. So I just want to take my time to answer that question. As you see, I do have a little bit of a passion for mathematics, but you know, what I have learned in our work with scientific learning is that if you can accelerate a child's learning versus focusing on the remediation aspect, the dividends are going to pay off in every subject, in particular mathematics, because it's very language-based. It's different from reading, but you do have to read to be able to do mathematics. We do know that investing early is critical, and investment in early childhood is where you get the biggest bang for your buck. But what I have found very exciting about our work with scientific learning, Paula Talal, the Steve Millers, the Mikes of the world, is that, you know, you never give up on a child. If you don't get them early, and there will be some children that you just can't reach, there's always that child that no matter what you do in early childhood, that they still need a little extra time. And what I find hopeful about the neuroscience is that no matter how old you are, what your circumstances are, that there's hope that you can be helped. And that's why I think that the work that you're doing here is so exciting. And people need hope. I look at the amount of money that we put into public education. Some say it's too much, some say it's not enough. You know, we can always use more money. Our General Assembly is arguing over that right now while I'm here in California. I hope they solve the problem by the time I get back. But, you know, at some point you do have to look at what you're spending your money on. And sometimes it's a matter of redirecting and shifting your focus. And I do believe this whole area has a lot of promise. But my parting message to you as researchers and scientists is find an educator as a partner to help you translate the message where it can be practiced and make a difference in the lives of children. Thank you.
Your comment about the language of the first panel, I actually don't know what it was like out there watching what the closed captioning lady was doing, but I'm very interested to see. Paul Houston, would you like to tell us a little bit about what your organization is, American Association of School Administrators?
American Association of School Administrators is the national association for school system leaders, so we're the ones that have the superintendents and the deputies and associates and that sort of thing. Don and Mike and I were talking during the break about what we were doing up here on a panel about brains. And I was particularly sensitive to that because I had several teachers when I was in school that actually questioned whether I had one or not. But I've been in Washington now for 14 years and working amidst all these people with who not only have brains, but they're like new because they've been used so rarely up to this point. So I guess that's why I'm here. I'd like to start by sharing a quote because when you don't know what you're talking about, you go and research what somebody else said. Progress in any art dates from the application of science. No sane man can doubt that there's a relation between the science of the mind and the art of teaching. The author went on to suggest that emotions and soul are also a part of it. It raises the question, is education a science or an art? And then answers his own question by saying, the arts are the practical endeavor of society to express its purpose. Obviously, education is therefore an art. That was from a book called A Study in the Science of Education by Herman Harold Moore, published in 1908. So we've been grappling with some of these questions for a very long time, and in many ways I think we've probably come a long way since Dr. Horn wrote his book, because we do have a lot of knowledge about the brain that we've really uncovered over the last several decades that really help us unravel a lot of the issues of learning and teaching. What shocks me is how little of that we tend to use in schools. It's not to say that not all you know, there are schools out there using it and using it pretty effectively, and there's a lot of people worrying about how to introduce more of it into schools. But there's a lot we know that we don't use. I mean, we know, for example, that teenagers' body clocks are different than the rest of the human race, and we still make them go to school at 7:30 in the morning. We know that the wiring for language acquisition takes place fairly early on, and we wait till they're in high school to teach language. So there's a lot of things we do that are sort of counterintuitive to what we're learning. I think part of it is, and it's been alluded to, is how do you get moved from the sort of perhaps what I would call the esoteric language of the science to a more accessible language that the practitioners can then put their hands around and do something with it. And then building it into the curriculum, and I'm very very respectful of scientific learning and companies like that that have really tried to dig in and actually put this in a way that it's accessible to the schools. But we have to worry about how to permeate the system with some of this. We have to worry about getting policymakers to pay much more attention to what we know. And I'm struck constantly dealing with policymakers about how so much of what we do in policy is exactly the opposite of what we actually know works. And so there's a real disconnect between policy and practice. And particularly concerned about how do we do all this in the context of creating a wholeness for children. Because I think Horn had some things right about the fact that there is elements of soul and there's art to this, and how do you do that? How do you make sure that you're not being mechanical, that you're being much more organic in the way that you do teaching and learning? With that thought, I just want to sort of end with this, a little bit of a contrarian notion, and it's not that I don't think all this we're talking about today is important, because I think it is, but I also think learning's about motivation. And children tend to learn when they're motivated. And so I think we have to create learning conditions for children that are meaningful and engaging, and perhaps the brain research can lead us towards some of understanding some of that better, but we also have to be connected to the kids. My great thought on school reform is to create schools kids want to go to. You know, and if we could figure out a way to make that situation available to them, I think we'd find learning starting to take place. And I think some of that has to do with creativity and figuring out how to apply creativity in all aspects of the school situation, both in what we expose kids to, but also how we teach. When I was in school, I didn't like math very much, and I didn't like science, and I wasn't real happy with social studies and English. A number of years later, I was superintendent of Princeton, New Jersey, and I was living amidst all these scientists and theoretical physicists and what have you. And when talking with them, I realized that the math that I'd learned in school wasn't really what math is. You know, math is really about elegance. And science that I learned in school wasn't really what science is. Science is about mystery. And it really occurred to me that we have to find a way in schools to make that turn from the way we've been teaching historically to making sure that it's focused on more on elegance and mystery for our children. And the last thing I would say, because they flashed a 30-second warning up here, our kids bring value with them. And we spend so much of our time in schools telling them what they don't know and what they can't do. And we've got to find a way of affirming the gifts that they bring and then taking those gifts, which are sometimes not totally formed or not totally appropriate to the setting, and figuring out how to help them turn into that setting.
Thank you. I think we'll hear later today that, in fact, a lot of the leading scientists, in fact, share your views. I mean, I think Leon Lederman, who's at the back there, talks about being hooked because he originally read a book by Einstein that read almost like a detective story. So the mystery was there, I think. Next, Kathleen Laos. Perhaps you could explain what the role is, president and CEO of the nonprofit corporation, the International Institute for Language and Literacy Development, and what you did before that as well.
Recently, I think I know so many of you in the audience today, Kathleen Laosen, former Associate Deputy Secretary to the Office of English Language Acquisition, which is Title III. And what I want to talk about a little bit today, and I will weave the question and responses into my response, is the fact that this is really a breakthrough day and a breakthrough moment. And I'm very honored and excited to be here with all of you today, because for so long we have struggled in this country about how you take theory and science and pure science and research and make it applicable in the classroom, and especially putting the tools that are necessary and the strategies that are necessary in the hands of teachers, that teachers can be effective based on science, and that schools can change based on research, and that students are effectively taught, and including them, what they bring into the discussion and into the equation. And I think today it's days like this where we take one world and bring it together with another world. Not that it hasn't been done before, and not that it's not done on a continual basis, but the importance of how these worlds must work together on behalf of making change in classrooms for students all over the country. And I've been fortunate to be in a position where I've taken what I say words off of paper in legislation and make it come alive in 52 entities around the country, which is this concept of language acquisition and content knowledge with standards and assessments and how we appropriately assess students in accountability systems based on standards and aligned curriculum, but especially for the students who are most vulnerable in the education system, and those are English language learners. And focusing on what they need with language development that's based on the research and the science of the development of full language, and this would be applicable for any student in any classroom throughout the United States, and how you wed that or bring that together with content knowledge in every single grade level as we go up the trajectory from three-year-olds or early childhood, pre-K, all the way through community college and colleges for all of our students, but certainly from my world with English language learners. We've made incredible strides in this area. There's fewer disconnects now than there were certainly 5 years ago and 7 years ago. And research has played a really key role in this. There are 121 citations in the last reauthorization of the education law that says that we must make decisions based on data and based on research and based on science. And when we look at that and we say, what does that mean? And I had an opportunity to go to the first discussion on the National Literacy Panel in 2002 and ask the researchers to sit with the teachers and say, as we are looking at the research, as we are distilling in the lit searches what has been done in the past, how can we make this applicable immediately into a classroom situation by having teachers in the discussion? So I know from the practical aspect, and because there are different types of researchers, there are different scientists. There are scientists in the labs, and I have the highest regard for the neuroscientists that really are looking at what happens with language as it impacts brains and how it increases cognitive capacity. But then also the researchers who are doing classroom application research, and they're sitting there with teachers, and we bring these worlds together for one reason only, and that is so that our children and our students will have all of the knowledge that they need to be successful in their academic career. Everything that we do supports that effort so that they will be the global citizens, not in the next century, but right now. That is the goal. So to start the conversation today where we have the administrators, the policymakers, the researchers, the scientists, and we begin to ask each other these questions of how do we come to the conclusions, not about a silver bullet, not about a program that works, but in a comprehensive way that we surround our children with everything that they need. Because when you look at, once, I've heard this over and over again, once that teacher closes the door, those kids are mine. Well, it's the teachers who need all the professional development and the strategies, because it is really true that they're impacting change with our children. But they've got to have the scientific research-based tools to be able to impact that change that our children will succeed. So I'm thrilled about today. And what I've just talked to you about is both what my company is doing, my former role, my current role, my future role, and I'm here in almost a national, international plea, in a sense, because I think if we together as administrators, scientists, researchers, also ask from our policy perspective, are we at a point in time in this country where we may want to ask Congress to commission yet another panel on the concept of language development and what does that mean? Thank you.
Thanks so much. Donald Phillips is a local superintendent from Poway Unified School District, former social science teacher. And want to say anything else, or go straight into your point?
It's great to be here. Although I had the same kind of aha last night, and actually it was yesterday afternoon, and we decided to walk on the beach since we weren't quite clear where this was going to head today. And I thought maybe clarity would come in the morning. And the beach was nice, if you were here yesterday. The intersection between policy, science, and practice is really something I deal with. So I was imagining sitting in my office as superintendent, and I get a call from Temporal Dynamics Learning Center, and that they would like to come and make a presentation to our school district on how they could help us with student learning, student achievement. And I'm sitting there kind of scratching my head thinking about why this group compared to another group. I must get hundreds of emails a day with new products and new ideas that are supposedly research-based to improve student learning. I am overwhelmed with different strategies. And as I look at our system in a school district of about 33,000 youngsters, 1,600 teachers, we have teachers doing a full range of different activities, engaged with different series of ideas, different folks that they find to be particularly powerful, but again, little consensus about what really would move our collective work forward. The challenges we face, and just to ground them, because as you think about this interface, is critical. We obviously struggle with how do you accelerate learning for all students, and we're concerned in a district that really focuses in on trying to prepare all youngsters to have the option to be college ready, which means we're setting high expectations and standards for all youngsters, not because they will all go to college, but we want children to have the choice rather than our choosing for them their future path, is how do you accelerate not only your most gifted youngsters or the ones who get bored because things are going too slowly, or the youngsters who are in the middle and who we hear a lot from parents saying, but my child is kind of doing okay, so not much is happening for them, or for those youngsters who are behind for whatever series of reasons. And we focus a lot on closing the achievement gap. And so as a superintendent in kind of this high-stakes world that's getting described, we're trying to find strategies, trying to create systems rather than just having islands of excellence in one classroom to the next that will really move the entire organization forward in powerful ways. So as I think about how that might happen, at least several of the questions that came to me this morning, one is we have what we call islands of excellence in our system, which is we have some phenomenal things going on in individual classrooms for youngsters. And it's somewhat the luck of the draw, depending upon which classroom your child attends. And we have some who are really excellent in one portion of the curriculum and not so strong in other portions. And so how do you kind of develop that broad base level of excellence and understanding, not only content but also in pedagogy, so that people are strong? But here's what's challenging for us. One is the absence of consensus. So as I listen this morning and try to think about what other discussions are going on around the country with different perspectives, if you think about medicine, there is the experimental phase, and then there is kind of best practice that emerges. And obviously, if we were still doing bloodletting, that would not be a good practice. We kind of know that about medicine now. But on the other hand, there are different theories about how to treat diseases. There's understanding of diseases, but that doesn't necessarily mean it leads to a cure or what that cure looks like, even when we can understand a particular phenomenon. And then how do you create kind of a level of practice that really takes the best and brings that together in a way that's understandable and manageable for practitioners? So the first would be to try to create this consensus, kind of what Mike was talking earlier about, this kind of clearinghouse, which is critical. The next is trying to understand the implications of the interactions and the activities. And what does that actually look like in the classroom? How do you translate what we saw this morning into behaviors and into the art and science and craft of teaching in a way that will be powerful? Then it needs to be a little more understandable. I apologize, but it needs to be put in a language. We'll have folks following this conversation in our district, but when I look at it, I need to make sure that all of our folks are following it, because it's not fair for some teachers and kids to get it and be in that environment and not others. And then the practical application, which is how do we provide the training and support for making this a reality? And again, the consensus is critical, because we're being pulled in 500 different directions at the same time. The focus on exercise is not about your brain matter. It's about the fact we have a lot of obese kids. That's what's driving that policy discussion right now. It has nothing to do with the brain research that's going on. And so how do these connect and make those connections across the different disciplines to create a more consistent policy? And finally, we need to create systems. I really believe that ultimately, unless we have clarity at the national, state, and local level in terms of what's important, what do we need to be doing in terms of both the content and also the process, that will fall short. So thank you for the invitation.
Okay. Now, since David Bolton and John Cochran are actually both going to make presentations, I think what we should do is have a panel discussion with them included in there, and then you can do your individual presentations after. Since you were both suggestions of Paula's, perhaps Paula will introduce you. But so can we take can we go to the audience now and find out what some of the responses are from people? I mean, anything from the neuroscientists who are being asked why they're presenting stuff in the way they do and why they can't talk to a general audience. And
okay. Well, I'm Carla Matheson from San Diego State University. I am a teacher educator. I'm not a neuroscientist, but I do teach a class on these kinds of things at the master's and the doctoral level right now. One of the things I'm finding is that there's a tremendous learning curve for educators. As teachers in teacher preparation programs, they don't come in having this background at all. And I was wondering from anybody in the panel or any of the neuroscientists here just how important they feel it is for in the teacher preparation programs for this curriculum to be introduced and at what level and what breadth and what depth.
Who would like to leap upon that one?
Well, I don't mind. I would say that I think the information, particularly with regard, and I'm not certainly not the expert in this, but with regard to time and timing of children learning is pretty important for teacher candidates. That would be something I would want them to be familiar with if I were in a hiring situation. I no longer am, but I would think that would be certainly something to include in their training.
Andrea, you have a mic up there.
If I could.
Sure.
I just wanted to respond a little bit, and this is now wearing my former hat from 2 months ago. But I think the question is a very timely question, and it's a really important question, whereas in my former status when we were allocating grant awards to institutions of higher education specifically on this issue of what institutions would change in order to redevelop their coursework curriculum for pre-service teachers, retrain their faculty, and in one instance I said to a few folks, literally walk across your campus and talk to you folks about speech-language pathologists and the development of language. Of course, I was looking at a specific field, et cetera, et cetera. And we actually did change the trajectory of the grant proposals themselves. Now, I grant you that that is a drop in the bucket, tiny little bit of money, and awarded just X amount of grants to institutions of higher education. But you have to start somewhere. And the fact that you are asking the institutions to change, and with all due respect to higher ed, I happen to know that they're very difficult institutions to change, and money speaks. So there are ways of making that happen because the teachers really honestly, especially there, not in the remediation district level process where they then get what they need later on after they've been in the classroom for 1 to 3 years, but up front get what they need. And so if we have to drive change that way, that was one of the last things I decided to do. So there's some little aspect of that taking place right now.
Yeah, before going to Andrea, I just want to follow that up with a comment that you made, which sort of, I was astounded. I think you said, Paul, that the policy is often the opposite of what we know works.
I was going to comment on that in regard to this, because I would answer this question in two ways. One is that I think a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing, and so I would, if we're going to go in the direction of arming teachers with this information, it needs to be pretty thorough. But the other side of it worries me, because I think because of this dichotomy between practice and policy, I think we do a lot of damage to our young teachers, because they get a lot of information and learning in their training, and then they get into the school setting and they run smack into the realities of policy, which are often very counter to the good teaching they've received about what they ought to be doing in the classroom. And so I think that somehow this has to be tied into some policy work, as well as just, you can't do it just with teacher training, it's got to be done in conjunction with policy work as well.
Sure, go ahead.
I couldn't resist, I didn't talk, I didn't know if it was proper for me to answer this. I learned to read when I was 48 years old, and I learned to read because I got proper instruction. And we have an epidemic of illiteracy in America, And the key to teaching people how to read and write and spell is proper instruction. And proper instruction comes from properly trained teachers. And properly trained teachers come from universities that properly prepare them. We have failed to properly prepare our teachers. There's a big gap between the science of what we know and what we do. And I think the third grade teacher is being held responsible for passing and teaching little children how to read, write, and spell. And I think the universities are equally responsible in breaking this cycle of failure and preparing teachers to teach people how to read, write, and spell.
Andrea, you still have a mic. Do you want to?
So regarding neuroscience in general,
plus this point, you've also been in a teaching environment as well. You could speak to this.
Right. I'm going to get there. So I think that neuroscience is a relatively new discipline, and basically it hasn't been integrated into multiple curricula enough. I mean, into the first grade curriculum, second grade curriculum, on up. Once you get to teacher education, there is a point at which cognitive development really is brain development. And so it does, of course, make sense to be teaching brain development to teachers because that's what they're teaching. They're teaching brains inside our children. And I actually began as a math teacher and then went to graduate school as a neuroscientist. And it was actually teaching that got me more interested in neuroscience than in cognitive psychology, which I was formerly trained in, because it seemed that there were these enormous individual differences and that every child had a different style of learning, and I sort of wanted to understand why. So it seems that we could actually educate our teachers more in neuroscience, and they'd probably have an appreciation for that as well. It's just not a part of every curriculum. I think later we'll hear from Kurt Fisher, who has integrated that as part of the Harvard curriculum.
You have a question, a point up there?
Soon we'll have a new administration, and with that, what will happen to the No Child Left Behind program?
Do you want me to answer? I'm involved in a process in Washington now with those who are looking at reauthorization, and I know that everyone's getting a lot of mixed messages, but there still is an effort both in the Senate and in the House to move that discussion forward, and then you will also hear a couple of senators say we're going to wait. So that's as of last Friday, as a matter of fact. Both of those messages are coming out about whether there will be reauthorization before we gear up as a country into national campaigns or whether we will wait.
Terry?
I'd like to pick up on a comment. I think it was either Mike or Paul who made it, that one of the most important variables in success for children is their motivation. And I know that I came from a family where education was very highly valued. And I know it's also true for Leon Letterman because I just read his autobiography. And so many parents now don't have those values. And I wonder if that's something that ought to be looked at very carefully too, because if a child comes into the classroom without that motivation, then there's going to be less learning.
I guess I would respond. In general, yes, you're right, but I also think that I have a deep belief in the power of teachers to make significant differences in the lives of children. And so I think that there's a lot of teachers who can take a kid who doesn't have the motivation, perhaps like I was, and do something with them by turning them on to their possibilities. So ideally, you have the home and the school working in coordination with each other, and then you've got something pretty powerful. When one or the other is absent, it's a lot harder for either one. It's hard for parents who have high motivation or have a child who's not getting the right kind of instruction to offset that. It's also hard for school to do that if the parents aren't there. But I do believe that there's still a lot of gifted teachers out there that do remarkable things for children, somewhat in spite of the system and in spite of the conditions that the kids come with.
Can somebody explain to me where this all gets out of sync? Where does the data get completely out of sync with policy? Or somewhat out of sync? Where does it happen? Where do you look for solutions?
Are you asking specifically on the concept of motivation?
No, I'm just still talking about this point. Policy. We still have policies opposite.
We have policy made by amateurs. They went to school, and therefore they're expert on the process because they received it. Now, I fly a lot, but I've never walked into the cockpit and tried to fly the plane, even though I feel that I'm a proficient flyer. But I think we've got a problem because everyone in our society has been to school, and therefore they consider themselves somewhat expert, and so a lot of policy gets made with pretty thin backing in terms of whether it makes sense, and a lot of it doesn't have a lot to do with whether it does make sense. It has to do with either a personal anecdotal experience of something that happened to them that therefore gets translated into policy, or, in many cases, well-meaning policymakers who think they're doing a favor by creating something that doesn't quite work the way it looked on paper.
Just to follow up on at the district or school level, we see a lot of inertia not to change. And so you might think there would be an openness to that, but what in effect happens is that the people who were successful in school when they were children look to schools to be very much like their own experience, want to duplicate that. So when you say we're going to try something new or different, they say, not on my child. I know it will work, and their children usually are successful in the current system. And so it's not just that inside the system there's resistance to change, but there's also in the immediate surrounding environment resistance to change as well.
If I could, I want to say a however. When you look at risk-taking superintendents and leaders and leadership in administrations at the local district level, in the classroom, in the schools, et cetera, and there are many, 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 many. And so much of the change, because of what we've defined as crisis, is now driven by data. So I think that it's less subjective, because I couldn't agree with you more about policy made by opinion and subjective analysis. However, the better we get at data-driven policy making, then I think we see systems change based on something that's more empirical.
Paula?
Right. I wanted to go back to this issue. We're going to have a whole panel on it, but I think that really the question about what gets taught in the teacher education programs is the crux of how we're going to move forward. If, first of all, we have a crisis in science literacy in general in this country, and we know that that is going to make us less and less and less competitive in the world as we see the science literacy of our population go down. And brain science is, as Andrea said, a new science, but one that has enormous implications across so many different domains that I think we need to even begin to think before the college level about incorporating brain sciences into our science curriculum. But at the level of teacher education, who better to start really focusing on in terms of increasing the science literacy in this country than teachers, and particularly the brain science literacy, than teachers, because after all, they're the ones who have the most potential to use it for good of our population. So in terms of what kind of curriculum, I think it would be a partnership, maybe this is a transformational moment, but a partnership that really had some teeth and some clout between the teachers of the heads of teachers of education systems in the country, and what it would take to really develop standards that included science literacy, particularly in how the brain learns. If we don't teach our teachers how the brain learns, how can they teach most effectively to the brain? And I'm going to hand this myself, take the prerogative to hand it to Nancy Parnon, who's head of teacher education.
Yes, as an old educator and school psychologist, my name is Sarah Frampton. I have a chance to go around to many school districts. And I think the elephant in the china shop, or whatever that saying is, I can't recall now, maybe someone could help me remember it, is that a budget and money is driving policy. If you just look at buying core curriculum textbooks on a state level, teachers can come out of a university setting and have lots of good ideas. But on a local level, if they're told, we use the core curriculum books adopted by this district and this is what you'll teach, and when you're not working out of these books, it's really important you teach to the high stakes testing, because after all, our kids are going to get tested at least once or twice this year. And then I go to meetings and hear that teachers are so eager to learn new ideas, but the district isn't investing in doing in servicing with them, so sometimes embarrassingly, I might know more, or a parent might know more than the teacher. They very much want to make what they're doing with the kids meaningful, but that has to be translated into practical things happening after they step out of a university setting. There's got to be a better partnership between what's happening in universities and your research people and what goes on in the classroom. So teachers fall back on that core curriculum text, and of course they have lots of data. When they shut the door, they do their own data. They research and calculate that in their heads, and they figure out what they think is working. And that's where the bridge is down, I think.
Okay, Nancy Farner.
I'm have a chance to say some of this a little bit later too as part of a panel, so I'm excited to do that. But one of the things that's real critical here is looking at the standards. We have standards in teacher preparation, just like you.
I'm just doing traffic directing while you're talking. Sorry.
For K-12 education, and there's an old, I think it's old because I heard it quite a long time ago, saying that goes something like, "You get what you inspect, not what you expect." And I think some of our standards mitigate against the kinds of things we're talking here. So that's one thing. And we also have systems, and I've heard this before today, that need to be looked at, because I know a lot of teachers in a lot of schools who say, I don't even have an opportunity to teach science. So they are not that interested in their professional development in science, where what is inspected is reading, which is critical, and we need to read, but we could also read in science and learn to read around science concepts. And that's a very simplistic statement, but the bottom line is we often don't see these kinds of these needs being played out, so teachers are compelled to do what they're required to do once they get into the school. So it's a very large systemic problem. It's not a school problem. It's not any one problem. I think it's many problems together. It's a very complex thing, and I am thrilled that we're talking about these things here.
So Gary Cantrell, then we've got about three or four other people.
I'll
come to you in a minute.
I have to respectfully disagree with my colleague Paula Talal. This is very dangerous for me. But I feel like, you know, the statement that, you know, if we don't teach teachers how brains learn, how will they know how to teach it? I mean, it's sort of like saying, well, if I don't understand the internal combustion engine, how can I drive? And I feel like, you know, Einstein said, you know, if we knew what we were doing, they wouldn't call it research. Scientists study things we don't understand, basically. And I read an interesting essay recently on the difference between science and engineering. And I was struck by the fact that what engineers do is clearly not science. What engineers have is knowledge of how to make things work. And I think maybe we should be talking about the engineering of teaching rather than the science. There was an article a while back in the New Yorker about, speaking of medicine, about the rise in cesarean sections. My apologies to the women in the audience about this. But it turned out that you could, there were very a great number of techniques for how to deliver a baby, and it depended on the way the baby presented. There was each of these techniques for getting the baby out had a name associated with the person who came up with the gesture that would pull the baby around and get the baby out. And so there was a great deal of art to delivering a baby. The rise of cesarean sections is because the problem with this, all these methods for delivering babies was they were very difficult to teach. And the people that came up with them don't use them anymore. They do cesarean sections, and the reason they do cesarean sections is they're easy to teach, and they're easy to do, and almost any doctor can learn to do a cesarean section. It seems to me we need to come up with teaching methods that are easy to teach and that work. And you know, understanding how the brain learns, I think, is important, but I'm not sure that it's important, as important as teaching teachers how to do things that work.
Einstein also said, keep everything as simple as possible, but no simpler, right? That's my favorite quote of his.
Well, there's a lady been waiting in the back there for a while. So.
Hi, I'm Margaret Ryle, and I teach at Pepperdine University, and I'm also a researcher at SRI International. And I guess I look back over a decade, almost a decade ago, the National Research Council, the Committee on Behavioral Sciences came out with a book on how people learn. And it's very clear about what scientists know about learning. I listened this morning, as you said, it's really more about process than it is about content. However, when we go to create policy and we go to put in place accountability measures, they're all about content, and they're all about a form of testing that, in fact, moves us away from what we know about learning. So it looks like to me that policy is actually working against putting in place what we believe would be a science-based way of learning. And I think that speaks to a failure of scientists to talk to people other than scientists. Because until scientists start talking to the public and start getting their ideas out into a forum where people understand what learning is, we will never see change in school. And one other comment, and I'd like to hear the panel's comments on this, is that teaching is continually an individual enterprise in a single classroom, yet almost all other groups have changed to a team approach to things. So why don't we have in our schools multiple people teaching in the same classroom? Because adults form a accountability system for one another. You perform better when you know another adult is watching you. So why not change schools in a way that we have adults helping one another teach better in schools? Because unless teachers are continually learning, schools aren't going to be places of learning.
Well, money would be one reason. Money.
So could we just go to David Lightfoot from National Science Foundation, see if Gary's talked himself out of one directorate to a director of engineering, or?
Okay, so I'm one of Paul's federal bureaucrats with one of those fresh unused minds. So Mike began the session by saying that in education we look for results. And it's been a pretty miserable session, right? I mean, these complaints about the lack of connection between policy and teaching practice, the lack of connection between what we understand about cognition and learning and teaching practice on the other. And Paula has talked about sort of declining science literacy and declining science aptitude. And one area where there are results are in the international surveys that get conducted and that show the U.S. steadily dropping in the scientific achievement of our 15-year-olds. So my question to the panel is, if the U.S. is dropping in this league table, there are other countries that are rising. One thinks particularly of Finland that seems to be off the charts. When you look around outside our shores, what do you see that might be worth trying to emulate?
There has been a study based exactly on the statement that you just quoted, and there is a discussion going on about national standards. Each one of the countries that outpaces the United States in the area of science and math, they are smaller countries and they have national standards. And in the United States, we do not have national standards articulated in the same way, I'll put it that way, because certainly there are boards of where math and science have their national standards, but they're not picked up at the state level and then just adopted as they are and then pushed through the system. So that's one area probably that would maybe stimulate some further conversation on this panel.
Yeah, I've looked at this pretty closely over the last 10 or 12 years because I've been in about 45 other countries, and many of them the ones that people want to compare us to. And I guess I'd make several observations. One is that the comparisons are dangerous. I was in Romania this fall, and Romania actually outscored us on the PISA study. But they flush most of their kids out at the eighth grade before going on to high school, so of course they would outperform us in the high school level if they only have the ones left that are really high achieving. Also, there are cultural differences that are really profound that make a lot of these results. Now, having said all that, I think that, again, the way we're teaching in many of the cases is really counterproductive to the ends we want to see. You know, if we're teaching kids and drilling them on something like science, instead of teaching them about the possibilities that science opens up, we're taking the wrong path. I was in Singapore several years ago, and of course they really outperform in math and science on us, partly because that's mostly all they teach. They don't teach a lot of the other stuff. But also, they teach at a depth that we don't teach. They'll spend a week on one you know problem in math. And work on and going through all the metacognition that goes with solving that problem. Our schools would never do that because somebody would come in and go, well, you're never going to finish the curriculum if you keep doing that. You know, you got to stay on pace. So we've got to change a lot of things about how we're doing internally to make it better. One last thing. The thing where we're indisputably number one in the world and have been for a very long time is creativity and ingenuity. And that's the one thing that's being sacrificed in all the stuff we're doing now. Because all these other countries are looking at us saying, how do we make our kids more creative like the American kids? And we're drilling all of our kids all day long and saying, you don't have time for art and music anymore because you got to get the test. So we've got to be really careful about all these things. But, you know, it's a complex set of issues.
We have some time problems coming up at this point. It's 12 o'clock already. So what I'm going to suggest is that we just have one of the speakers now, David Bolton, just do... take us through to lunch, and then John, perhaps you could bring us back after lunch. A lot of these issues, we obviously will continue. I've got a mass of things I want to ask about scientific literacy. I want to know if any of you have looked at sciencedebate2008.org, the website, which a lot of scientists are contributing to in terms of trying to ensure that there is a scientific debate of some kind before the election. And to find out what the candidates' positions are on science, which seem to be rather obscure. But so let's thank the panel. We're going to hear from David Bolton. David Bolton, I'll just simply say, Children of the Code, and it'll become clear what he's talking about. John will talk to afterwards.
Well, thank you. It's a great honor and privilege to be here. I wish I had more time to just do the thanks, but I'm going to be really compressed, and everybody wants to get to lunch, and I have a lot to cover in a short period of time, like everybody else. I've never felt more sympathy for people than everybody trying to cram their thing into 5 minutes. I can't imagine. A lot of what I'm going to say, I think, is going to connect up to what we've been talking about this morning, particularly about mission of education, because I think at the core of all of this conversation is we're misoriented, fundamentally misoriented, in terms of what we're at, the intention of education is. Right? And the other thing that we haven't been doing very well, I think, is bringing the participation in, that it's not just a brain, it's not just a machine, it's a human being, and the being has to participate. And it's the quality and health of that participation that has to be, I think, the kind of central organizing principle. Let me start that process of kind of our descent into this conversation today with this little piece on learning itself.
The Nourish Neighborhoods report was very emphatic in stating that children are born ready to learn. We don't have to make them ready to learn. We don't have to teach them how to learn. They are kind of wired from the beginning to learn. And they're wired to experience and to master the world around them.
What is important about education is not that somebody knows the current science, because the current science might be wrong, but it's that somebody knows how to learn about new science and adapt to do something that they had never even thought about doing when they were in school. That's the key element.
Yeah, for me. So, I mean, on one hand, you've got somebody who's overseeing the gathering of what we have on neuroscience of early childhood development, saying that, in essence, we come into the world born learning-oriented, wired to differentiate and disambiguate and extend our presence into the worlds we inhabit. We come that way. On the other hand, we've got somebody who is sitting at the Hoover Institute studying education. I've also talked to other people in similar positions around the country who are studying kind of the macro dynamics of education, saying, what is it that makes education really work? And what he's come to is basically that what we need to do is be producing people that are learning-oriented. In other words, so we're born learning-oriented, and the purpose of education isn't so much to teach us any particular thing as it is to get us through the process able to learn in ways that we can't be educated about at the time we're being educated. So both of these two things. Now, the difference between them, even though there seems to be such significant agreement between the two, is that one is talking about natural, organic learning. We are wired, we come into the world with this kind of proprioceptive, self-sensing feedback that can differentiate and allow us to disambiguate our way into being more present in the world. We come with that. But we don't come with any such ability to be able to differentiate and extend ourselves into the artificial, cultural, technological world. And the purpose of education is to be able to connect that kind of natural internal learning orientation and make it able to learn in this artificial world. But for the most part, teachers, parents, educators, we're kind of oblivious to the difference between a natural learning context and an artificial learning context. And without it, I don't know how you could possibly organize education effectively. And there's no place better to go into a lens into those differences than in understanding the code itself. So backdrop real quickly, our perspective is that everything depends on learning, our physical health or emotional health. Learning isn't just the process of utility through for the acquisition of knowledge, skills, and experience. Learning is the central dynamic through which we become human beings. And it's not only connected to each and all of us as individuals, but it's connected to everything about us collectively as well. So our mission and what we do with our work at the Children of the Code Project and other things is what we call stewarding the health of learning. And that's the thought bomb kind of at the end. One other thing I'd ask for you to think about as I proceed on with this and into the Children of the Code conversation is that... is to think about this question. What happens to children who develop a preconscious emotional aversion to the feeling of confusion? Talk about motivation. It's not just pumping up motivation. It's making sure that they don't become emotionally motivated to avoid learning, which is, when you deconstruct it, the number one learning disability in this country, more than everything else we keep track of put together. And it's right there at the intersection between the emotion and cognitive dimensions of things that this conversation about reading takes place. So to set a backdrop for this briefly, I want to say just a little bit about what Children of the Code means. It has two different meanings. One has to do with the power of this code and its effect on our world.
The bottom line of this is that the big step between us and animals is indeed language, but the big step between civilization and more primitive forms of human society is written language.
The fact is that the invention of writing system, of a writing system, and then the adoption of writing systems around the world has been the thing that gives our modern societies their predominant character.
Well, it has enormous metacognitive implications. The power is this, that you can not only think in ways that you could not possibly think if you did not have the written word, but you can now think about the thinking that you do with the written word.
Once we start writing, we are able to then reflect back upon what we have written, and we enter into this kind of recursive relation to our own written signs.
I cut him off there in the interest of my abbreviating time a little bit. So on the one hand, we're all children of the code. More than any single invention in the history of history, this has changed everything about the world, our institutions, how they function, how they're organized. But it's also changed how we meta-reflect, how we relate to language itself. So it's just super critical on the one hand. On the other hand, this is recapitulated with each child.
If I read a book and then I feel like a lot smarter.
Does reading make you smarter? The answer is yes. Crystallized intelligence is just massively built by reading itself okay, independent of education, independent of fluid intelligence.
Ultimately, the measures of your cognitive abilities tend to move down in the direction of your reading abilities.
Having said that, that on the one hand, that this is building the infrastructure for high-speed abstraction, for a complex virtual assembly, right? I mean, reading, after all, is a code-instructed and informed virtual reality system that projects a simulated language into comprehensibility in our minds. And it's all based on a huge number of variables about the early life learning trajectory of children and how well it prepares them for all of this. But when I said children of the code, I meant it, I had two different meanings for it, one having to do with the effect that this has had on all of us, and the other one to understand the effect that this is having on children.
Approximately 70% of young African-American kids can't read. 70%. If you look at Hispanic kids, 65 to 70%.
And as we know, a majority of students do not read at the proficient level.
Proficient. Most of our 64% of 12th graders in this country are below proficient. 88% of African-American 4th grade children. 78% of Hispanic children. You can argue quite a bit with NAEP and whether how much you want to discount it, but it's still enormously significant. And what that means when you translate it to proficiency is those children that are not proficient, that their entire educational experience as channeled through the requirements of literacy to access what's going on in school, they're underwater. It's muddled. Their brain energy, their learning participation is weakened. Their learning challenges they're experiencing are exacerbated by the degree of difficulty associated with the reading.
93 million adults out of a total adult population of around 221 million are at basic literacy levels or below basic.
The collective costs on this is measured in the hundreds of billions. It's close to $1 trillion a year. It dwarfs the cost of war on crime, drugs, everything else that we can imagine. It's the single biggest expense of education. And for the most part, this connects to the conversation we're having about teaching in general, is that teachers are becoming, have become, and I've talked to hundreds of them and dozens of people that study teacher behavior, they've become robotic conscripts to protocols of instruction that they don't first person understand. So the center of this difficulty is a form of confusion.
How do you feel when you read? My brain hurts. It hurts?
My brain is starting, my head starts hurting. It's like it kept on boom, 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 just beating. I didn't even know the word.
It's pretty difficult, like putting sounds to these symbols, knowing the difference between one and another, knowing that some are numbers and some are letters, and that you can put them together and they form a whole completely different thing.
I get confused a lot because I'll sit there and I get frustrated. It's no fun. I don't like reading.
And I can't understand what it's saying.
We're talking about children experiencing a form of confusion that's unnatural to their organism.
I think that's an interesting and good way to frame things.
I suspect the most letters that are in your sort of foveal zone or the area right around your fixation are probably being processed pretty much in parallel, so I don't think we need to think of them as, you know, one 25 millisecond, another 25 milliseconds, but averaged over them,
yeah,
it's going to be about 25 milliseconds, yeah. Very fast, staggeringly fast. Most of the time, it appears that the eyes are being driven largely by lexical processing of the words, so that when there's higher order comprehension issues that are coming in, there will be times when the eyes will slow down for that. But for the most part, the eyes are being driven by how easy or hard the word is.
See.
This goes on, it takes a couple of minutes for it to play out, so I got to shorten it. But I would say, as I move from this particular thing back to here. What we're describing is a form of confusion that a child's mind has, you know, a tenth of a second or so on average to resolve, to disambiguate the letter sound correspondences. Remember that language itself is operating with a temporal profile. It's moving at an incredible rate. The process of reading actually has to artificially simulate at that rate or it's not comprehensible. Right? So there's this incredible assembly, and at that assembly rate, this confusion has to be worked out. If that confusion isn't, if the life learning trajectory of the child at the point that they intercept this confusion hasn't prepared them for their brain to work preconsciously that fast to disambiguate this code sound situation, they start to become in danger. Their entire life trajectory.
What must it be like to come to school every day, right? And school is going to be all about the thing that you don't do well.
Spending any amount of time in classrooms where children are working on beginning reading instruction, you can almost watch children who are struggling begin to turn off and exhibit behaviors that are going to interfere with their learning.
I remember feeling pretty dumb.
I wasn't smart. I thought I was not smart because I couldn't read like everybody else could.
Growing up, I thought it was me the whole time. I thought something was wrong with me.
So again, what happens? What happens when, at an early age, you develop an aversion to how bad it feels to feeling confused? And it starts to operate just like reading itself, faster than you're even aware of. It's underneath your consciousness, and it's causing your consciousness to avoid doing things that will cause you to feel confused because you don't want that shame. What happens to your life learning trajectory? That's why there's such a connection, I think, and the research we've done. We've conducted 120-plus interviews, 400 hours of tape. There's about 150 little videos like this of much greater length that are available on our website for those of you that are interested. I'd like to take I want to take a couple of more pops through this.
It's just almost as though you have to mesh with that code in a time sync so that that sequencing and processing can happen, you know, in a kind of parallel way so that all of those gears have to mesh. That's a lot of gears to mesh.
What we're really doing is we're taking something that is a nightmare for computation. And yet we have to turn it into, as we mature, both as language users, but also as readers and writers, we have to automatize it so that we don't have to think about those details.
That is critically important. To the extent that I have to invest real cognitive energy in figuring out what that word is, I've lost the meaning of the sentence. It's gone, right?
The problem with automatization is that at any step, if you've got a slowdown step, if any piece of that enterprise has a block or you can't hold enough of the information, the whole house of cards falls apart.
Here's the thing that we as a society, parents, teachers, siblings, the way the school works, is that we conspire to cause children to feel like their inability to work out this confusion. Here they're 4, 5, 6, 7 years old. Their inability to resolve the confusion in this messy, archaic, technological artifact is somehow a reflection of something deeply wrong with them.
When kids are hesitant, disfluent, inaccurate, slow and labored in reading, that is very visible to the peers, and the peers, the other kids, again, look at reading as a proxy for intelligence. It doesn't matter if this kid is already a genius and can do algebra in the second grade. Reading produces particular perceptions. Better said, lousy reading produces a perception of stupidity and dumbness to peers and clearly to the youngster who is struggling. That is the shame.
When I was reading to my friend and I got stuck on a word and then when it was at recess, I heard her talking, saying that I can't read so good. It made me feel kind of scared that I'm not smart.
And I don't like reading out loud. I get embarrassed.
pause that a second. What's everybody's consensus on the number one fear of that adults have in this country? Speaking out loud. What is it we ask 5 and 6 year old kids to do in the classroom? While in the process of learning this convoluted, complex, horribly, you know, confused process?
Being asked to read out loud in front of a class, which is a very typical elementary school reading activity, can be a terribly humiliating situation.
My teacher asked me to come into the front of the class and read a book, and everybody was just staring at me, and I got real nervous because I didn't want to mess up or anything. And then when I started reading, I started messing up, and I just couldn't help it, and everybody started laughing at me and stuff. So,
like, the teacher would ask me to read something, and I would read it, and I'll get a wrong word, or I'll go too slow, and they'll make fun of me.
I kept messing up on the words, and people kept laughing at me.
They said that you don't know how to read. I bet you won't be able to how to read when you grow up.
They always laugh at me if I get twisted up with words. It makes my heart drop because it seems like they're not my friend no more.
Ever since then, I've been comfortable reading in front of people. And they made fun of me and stuff, so I just never really liked to read after that.
The greater the number of experiences of reading in which a child experiences shame, the more likely it is that every experience of reading is going to be associated with the expectation of shame.
I'm nervous.
Nervous makes me feel Shy?
What does shy mean?
When you're scared to do something and there's a whole bunch of people around.
I'd start sweating. I'd be like, I don't know if I'd literally start sweating, but I would. I'd get real nervous, and you could see that I was getting nervous and embarrassed.
So the point in all this is that we're not just talking about a machine. When we talk about this brain, we're talking about somebody inside of it, an inhabitant, somebody who has feelings. And those feelings, the emotions, the affect, is actually regulating what they're able to pay attention to, how long they're able to pay attention to. And once that emotional circuitry doesn't want to be paying attention, you can do all you want in the classroom, and you got to fight against that. And in fact, most of the kids that are struggling are no longer struggling just with the original issues. They're become learning disabled by the emotional avoidance they have to wanting to get anywhere near the confusion. So I wish I had more time. That's it for now. Yeah.